You are listening to the Hebein Podcast, where scholarly research into the Hebrew Bible and ancient Near East is brought directly to you.
Welcome back, everyone, to the Hebein Podcast. Megan and I recently had the pleasure of speaking with Jay Caballero, a PhD student in his final stages of studies at the University of Texas at Austin. Now, the topic of our discussion was sex crimes in the ancient Near East, rape, adultery, consent. We deal with them all in today's podcast.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Digital Hammurabi, where we believe that ancient history really is for everyone. I'm your host, Megan Lewis, and I'm joined by my co-host, Dr. Joshua Bowen, and today's guest, Jay Caballero. Jay is a PhD student at the University of Texas at Austin in the Middle Eastern Studies Department, and has very kindly agreed to talk to us about sex crimes in the ancient Near East. Jay, hello again, and welcome to Digital Hammurabi.
Nice to be here.
It's good to have you back. So some of you may remember Jay actually interviewed early in the summer as part of our Humans Against Poor Scholarship program. So he said after the interview that he'd be very willing to come back and go into a bit more detail about his research. And we have, as you can tell, jumped on that, because who doesn't like talking about laws and legality surrounding sex and sexuality? So Jay, would you mind just introducing yourself and telling us a bit about how you got into the field?
Sure. Obviously, I'm Jay Caballero. I'm a sixth-year PhD student at the University of Texas. Again, my field is Hebrew Bible in the ancient Near East, and I'm writing a dissertation on sex crimes in the ancient Near East, focusing specifically on sexual assault, incest, same-sex relations, and bestiality. I am not doing what I would call plain vanilla adultery. doing a little bit more fringe than that. I practiced criminal defense for almost 20 years in my prior life, so my PhD is actually my midlife crisis. So
it's a productive midlife crisis.
Right, it's a productive midlife crisis. So to some degree, I hate to say this, but it's doing what I know. And so when I first started thinking about a dissertation topic, I'd considered doing homicide or murder, but that's already been done by Pamela Barmash. So I moved on to sex crimes, which some of this stuff has been done. A lot of stuff on adultery, a little bit of stuff on sexual assault, but nobody's really looked at it from sort of a global perspective. What's going on in sort of all of the ancient Near Eastern writings, the Akkadian writings, the Hittite writings, the Hebrew writings, for these four sort of more fringe sexual activities, and maybe coming up with legal philosophy or philosophies or moral philosophies for why these particular behaviors were criminalized. And I am looking specifically at stuff that is criminalized. So just because it might be frowned upon is not really my interest. It's things that seem to merit criminal penalties. And of course, that almost is ubiquitously the death penalty.
Wonderful. Thank you. So we've kind of covered your very specific area of research. I did send you some questions ahead of time, and looking at the questions now, I see that most of my questions are actually about adultery.
totally my fault. Yeah, totally.
That's okay. Because to really talk about rape in the ancient Near East, you have to start with adultery. You have to get a good foundation of what adultery is, because rape is not a sexual assault is not conceived as we would conceive it. It really is sort of an offshoot of adultery. So to even start to have that conversation, we do need to lay a groundwork for adultery so that everybody understands once we move to sexual assault.
Well, I'm glad that we're not completely pushing you way, way, way outside of what you're looking at. So starting off then with rape, what were the laws regarding and regulating, well, not regulating is the wrong word, but regarding rape in the ancient Near East and the Hebrew Bible, and what might surprise us about them?
So the most important thing to understand, again, is that rape is, it's really an offshoot of adultery. Adultery is the primary sexual crime that they're looking for. And so we need to start with what constitutes adultery, and then we can talk about how rape is an offshoot of that, or to some degree, it's really a defense against the charge of adultery, and mostly for women, obviously. So in the ancient Near East, adultery is specifically defined. It's not specifically defined by anybody, but how I would specifically define it is sex between a man and a married woman. And so who is not his spouse, obviously. So that eliminates what a lot of people would consider to be adultery today when we talk about that. So if we talked about a married man having sex with some single woman who is not his spouse, obviously, we would consider that to be adultery. That's not adultery for the ancient Near East. And obviously there is a gender bias there. So understanding that is the first step. It's sex between any man and a married woman who is not his spouse. So if a married man has sex with a single woman, not his spouse, that's not adultery. That doesn't get you into any sort of criminal offense. Basically, that is a prelude to a second marriage. And if you there are laws that say if you have sexual intercourse with a virgin or a maiden, an unbetrothed woman, somebody who's never had sex before, then you have to pay a bride price and you have to marry her. And often there's a penalty that's associated with that. So it might be twice the bride price or three times the normal bride price or something like that. So you do get penalized to some degree for taking a woman sexually where there hasn't been a prearranged marriage with the father. But that's not adultery. And so those are what you might call civil penalties or, an administrative penalty or something like that, but it's not a criminal penalty. Mm-hmm. So that's the first thing that most people would be surprised at. The second thing that is sort of interesting about adultery, and this sort of taps into the rape thing as well, is that the husband of the woman who is involved in this illicit relationship or illicit act gets to really decide what the penalty is for both his wife and her paramour, her lover. And so if he catches them in the act, then he has the right to kill them both. And the law pretty much allows that and says that's okay. Mm-hmm. He also has the option of dragging them to court. And if he drags them into court and the court finds that they've committed adultery, then whatever punishment he gives the wife, the man gets corresponding punishment to that as well. And so if he wants to have her killed, then her lover gets killed as well. If he wants to mutilate her, then her lover gets mutilated as well. If he wants to let her go free and he doesn't want to punish her at all, then her lover also goes free and doesn't get punished at all. So there's a tremendous amount of power that's vested into the wronged husband, if you will, the husband of the adulterous woman. He has a lot of power to decide what the criminal punishment is that will be meted out to both his wife and her lover. Now, let's move on to rape. My focus is on what the laws are, mm-hmm. the law codes, and obviously I'm sure you've discussed with the audience before, we don't really know what the law code is or what its function is supposed to be that Hammurabi or the Middle Assyrian laws or the biblical codes as well. So I'll use that term law code sort of as a, because it's been used traditionally, but we're still not exactly sure what it's supposed mm-hmm. to represent. But in those law codes, there are several places where they talk about sexual assault. And sexual assault is really limited. The what they would conceive of sexual assault is limited to really the location in which the sex takes place. Mm-hmm. And so if a woman is having sex with a man in a city or in her own house, she cannot allege that sexual assault occurred. By definition, they believe if you're being raped in a city, you're going to fight back, you're going to cry out, you're going to do something to resist. And it would seem to be, they don't say this explicitly, but it seems to be the case that they expect the woman to die rather than to give in. So the notion that we have today, which is very common, is that the woman sort of needs to, when she knows she's going to be sexually assaulted, is just to get through the process, however it takes for her to do so safely for herself, or as safely as possible. Obviously, the sexual assault itself is a massive injury. But beyond that, women are trained to try to get through that assault without incurring any other injuries. It doesn't seem that the ancient Near East takes that approach at all. They seem to be of the mindset that if you're going to be sexually assaulted, you better die fighting, which is just sort of crazy talk to us. And so that's why they have their rules. It seems to be set up the way they do. So if you're in the city, you don't get to claim rape because you would have yelled out, you would have fought back, somebody would have found it, something like that. Conversely, if the alleged sexual assault occurs outside of town, on a highway, in the mountains, or something like that, then they seem to presume that sexual assault actually did take place, which is very odd. They don't really seem to make any sort of investigation about that. It's taken to be the case that if a woman has sex in a deserted place and there's no way to prove that she consented, that she did not consent. And so she is not punished, but the male is the only one that's punished in those cases. So that is kind of weird and bizarre, at least to me. I think it's probably weird and bizarre to most modern audiences to hear. The location of the sex actually matters in determining whether or not sexual assault took place.
So if it was in the mountains, then, or outside of a civilization, women were not expected to essentially fight to the death to prevent the assaults?
Functionally, that's the case. I think what they would say is, yeah, we expect that women are resisting. And so if you are out on the road in the mountains, there was nobody there to hear you resist.
I see.
And so we're going to assume that you did. And so conversely, in the city, we assume you will resist, and we assume that somebody's going to hear this.
I see.
And so if you aren't heard, you weren't actually resisting.
So it wasn't actually rape.
Yeah.
I see.
Correct.
Thank you. So we kind of touched a little on this. With adultery and rape, who exactly is the wronged party in this kind of criminal proceeding?
So the wronged party is always the male that has control over the female. And I hate to use that term, but that's really what it comes down to. So it appears that a woman doesn't really control her own sexuality for the most part. Now, there are extreme cases, or not extreme cases, but other cases of women who've been divorced or women who are widows where they seem to be able to control their own sexuality. But for the most part, there's a male that's involved. So if it's a young girl, until she's married, then it's going to be her father. And once she's married, then it's going to be her husband. And husband is an interesting term that we would use. They use differently than we would use. Once the engagement contract is entered into, then the husband-to-be becomes the husband. And so there are some laws that talk about if a man has sex with a virgin wife. So that means that the contract has been entered into for her to marry somebody else, but the consummation of that marriage hasn't taken place. And so the wronged party is the husband-to-be, even though she's still residing in her father's house, and to some degree she's under the protection of her father's home. And so you have this sort of weird hybrid where she's not actually what we would consider to be a full wife, but she's not really just a daughter either. Mm-hmm. But in either case, there is a male that is actually the wronged party.
Thank you. And going slightly off script from the questions I sent you earlier, when we're looking then at incest specifically, like father-daughter incest, is the crime still considered to have been committed against the father if the woman is unmarried or not engaged to anyone?
Right. So here's the weird thing is that there are not very many laws about father-daughter incest. Mm-hmm. It seems not to have been talked about very much. And so that's one of the questions, you know, especially it comes up about the passages in Leviticus, is you have all these people named that can't have sexual relations, but father-daughter is never mentioned. And so I would guess, this is just a guess without proof, mm-hmm. that since the father is the one who has the financial interest in daughters being virgins when they're married, that they sort of anticipated that would take away any incentive or any desire for a father to engage in sexual activity with his daughter, mm-hmm. because it's against his financial interest. Now, of course, that wildly misunderstands the nature of incest and why those things take place. But I think that's probably what's going on there, is it doesn't get mentioned that much because why would you do that? You're just losing money.
It's so stupid. That, yeah.
Yeah. It's stupid.
I see.
Without really understanding the psychology behind father-daughter incest, which is incredibly unique. As I'm sure some people may know, those who molest within their family tend not to molest outsiders. So if somebody commits sexual assault against somebody within their own family, an incest type situation, they are generally not a danger to anybody else. It's only the people within their family. Mm-hmm. So it's a unique psychology. They probably didn't understand it then, and they're just going off the money issue.
We're going to take a short break, but when we come back, we will continue our conversation with Jay Caballero, a PhD student from the University of Texas at Austin, on the topic of sex crimes in the ancient Near East. Stay tuned. Here at Digital Hammurabi, we believe that everyone should have access to the amazing information and discoveries that come from the ancient world. That's why we founded HAPS, Humans Against Poor Scholarship, a nonprofit organization that provides students of the ancient world with opportunities and funding to bring groundbreaking research directly to you. Why not consider becoming a patron so that the mysteries of the ancient past can be brought into the 21st century? See digitalhammurabi.com for more details. That's digital, HAMMURABI.com.
So going specifically to the Hebrew Bible, could you discuss Numbers 5 and the ritual that it has for determining the relative guilt or innocence of a woman suspected of adultery?
Sure. The Tzotah. There's at least one other situation that's sort of similar to this, but it seems that Numbers 5 is probably the most elaborate. And it's an uncomfortable passage. I think it's supposed to be. It's incredibly demeaning to women. But what the passage states is that if a husband is overcome with jealousy, is how it's phrased. And so he doesn't have any real proof that his wife has acted inappropriately sexually, that he has no real proof that she's taken a lover or that she's had an illicit affair or anything like that. He's just overcome with jealousy. Then he can bring her to the temple or to the tabernacle in Numbers 5. And present an offering to the priest. And then the priest performs this ritual in which he makes the wife drink water that's mixed with dust and some shavings from a scroll that contains a curse that he reads out. And she drinks this potion. And if she's been unfaithful, then her reproductive system is supposed to drop out of her. And then conversely, if she hasn't been unfaithful, then she's supposed to be fine. You know, she won't be affected by this curse. Mm-hmm. And of course, again, for me, what's very disconcerting about all of this is at the end of it, end of the passage, it makes this notation that says that basically the man is not, he's not to be prosecuted. He hasn't committed any crime. He hasn't done anything morally wrong, even if it turns out that his wife passes the test. And so the test itself is ugly. The fact that they have this procedure is ugly. But then at the end, it sort of gives him a pass on the fact that, you know, he's just kind of a nut job. And
yeah.
And has subjected his wife to this very humiliating ordeal that she ends up passing. And then, well, there's no consequence for the man.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting because, I mean, I haven't like delved into the river ordeal. And of course, this is compared to the river ordeal quite a bit. But there are penalties quite often for the accusing party if someone passes the river ordeal, right?
In some of the other laws, there are. Now, it doesn't say specifically if they pass the river ordeal, but it says if they make some sort of an accusation and they're unable to prove it, then yes, there are penalties for the false accusation. Absolutely. As well, there probably should be, especially if you're going to subject people to this sort of, again, public disgrace. But within the Hebrew Bible, and specifically in Numbers 5, there's nothing. And again, it specifically says the husband does not get penalized.
Do you know, so we, Josh mentioned briefly the river ordeal. Do you know of any other rituals or tests that are comparable in the wider ancient Near East?
No, those are the only two that I know of right off the top of my head is mm-hmm. Numbers 5 and then the river test, which is... not specified. You know, Numbers 5 gives very specific details as to how it's to be done. Mm-hmm. In the laws of Hammurabi, which talk about the river ordeal or talk about with respect to the suspected adulterous wife, it just says they throw her in the river. You know, she just suffers the ordeal and that's mm-hmm. it. And it's sort of understood what it's supposed to be. So there aren't any law codes that we found that specify how the river ordeal is intended to be worked out. They just assume everybody sort of knows what it is. Mm-hmm.
If I could, I mean, obviously with Numbers 5, the question that I always get, and I'm sure that you get when you talk about it, is, you know, is this the law condoning abortion, right? And my response is always, I don't think that's the intent of the text. I don't think the text has the fetus in mind. But what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I agree with you. I think that it's not contemplating that she's pregnant. It's just contemplating her potential promiscuity. And that's what it's doing.
I guess my response to it always sort of entails, look, if you're reading this as sort of like, you know, a fundamentalist evangelical perspective, and you're saying these were laws that were given and then were carried out, and it taking it that way, then certainly, I think the verbiage earlier in the passage is there's a seminal omission by the man. And so if we assume the reality of this situation and then assume that it was carried out and it was carried out in with any kind of frequency, then yes, that would have happened. there would have eventually been a pregnancy that would have been aborted. But I think that's, again, I think that's coming to the text the wrong way. Yes. So,
yeah, I think that's bringing a wrong hermeneutic.
Yeah.
And not stepping into the shoes of the ancient Near Eastern author and readers, bringing much too much of a 20th or 21st century perspective to it. Of course, you know, we don't know what exactly the formula is, because the base is the waters of bitterness, whatever that meant. So that plus dust plus some ink generally is not going to cause a woman's reproductive system to drop out of her or cause an abortion.
Whatever that means.
Whatever that means. So, I the efficacy of this ritual
maybe should be called into question.
You have to wonder, okay, even if this was administered, I just don't see many women failing the test as it's sort of written.
Is it maybe like a placebo to make her husband feel better?
Yeah, right.
It very well might be, because, you know, it goes to great pains to say he has no proof. It's just
just feels bad.
He's got this sort of unremitting jealousy.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, we can conceive of, you know, if you understand the dynamics of family violence, dating violence, marital violence, and things like that, very often it has to do, or it's based in a jealousy by the husband that has no basis.
Mm-hmm.
He's just sort of crazy. If to a large degree, probably projecting onto his wife his own foibles and problems. And so you very well may be correct that they did understand that psychology, and this is written in as a way to mollify him.
And to maybe even protect his wife from
yes.
future accusations. She can say, look, I did the test. I passed the test. It's okay.
Yeah.
God cleared me of this.
Yeah. And I suspect even further, you know, obviously Jay, you know more about this than I, but I mean, from a legal standpoint, with inheritance rights, if there's a baby that's born, we can look back and say that she underwent this test. This is my legitimate child. There's no reason to question this.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. We know how important, inheritance and passing the land on to legitimate children was. And so, yeah, it's strange. It looks like it's supposed to be presented as a serious test, but the process seems to indicate, as Megan said, probably more of a placebo. We're just going to mollify the husband. Give her sort of this certificate that says she's okay, make sure that the legitimacy of the children is never in question, and move on.
Thank you. So we've kind of talked about like how laws differ based on a person's sex. How does legal status play into this kind of thing, whether one is slave or free?
Sure. There's not a lot that's written on sexual assault, and there's certainly, I don't think there's anything written on sexual assault of slaves. There are a few laws that talk about having just sexual intercourse, so consensual sexual intercourse with a slave. And those all end up in monetary penalties. And so there's one in, let me see, I have a note here. So in the laws of Urnama, if you have sex with somebody else's virgin slave, you have to pay the owner 5 shekels of silver. So, and again, it doesn't, I think I can almost say, I can say 99%, that I'm right about this. a married man having sex with a slave woman is, again, not that doesn't even rise to you have to take her as a wife.
Mm-hmm.
That's just their property. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately,
that's anticipated.
We've been speaking with Jay Caballero from the University of Texas at Austin. When we come back, we'll conclude our discussion on sex crimes in the ancient Near East. Stay with us.
Thousands of years ago, an ancient civilization made unprecedented technological advancements. The mysteries of this civilization can be found in their writings, buried away for thousands of years. Scholars have deciphered these ancient tablets, and now you can too. Learn to Read Ancient Sumerian, an introduction for complete beginners, is your guide to reading these writings from the ancient past. Get your copy today and begin reading this long-lost language tomorrow.
So, interestingly, if slaves are considered property and therefore you can do what you want to them, how does bestiality fit into that kind of owner property sexuality mindset?
So, we have to understand bestiality is only addressed in two law codes. It's addressed in Leviticus, so it's addressed in the P code, and it's addressed in the Hittite code.
Mm-hmm.
It's not addressed in any of the Mesopotamian codes. So, as far as we can tell, at least even if it was frowned upon, it never rose to the level that somebody felt like they needed to write down a criminal law about mm-hmm. that. Within the Hittite corpus, there are actually distinctions made between sex with different kinds of animals. So there are certain animals that you can have sex with that is not criminal, and there are other animals that if you do have sex with them, that is criminal. I think that the distinction that is made there, has to do with the animals that are used for purification ceremonies, because that's how the list reads.
Mm-hmm.
The stuff that you can't have sex with also happens to be the animals that are used for purification, except for the mouse. But
okay.
You know, physiologically, yep. we don't really need to worry about that. But the others, the sheep, the cow, dog, and chicken, unfortunately, all of them have been used for sexual activity by humans. And so what it seems to be the case is that the Hittites are worried that somebody's going to have sex with one of these purification, one of these animals used for purification, and then that animal is going to get used in a ceremony, and the purification will not be efficacious.
Mm-hmm.
And the worst part that could possibly happen is that the king uses one of these animals for purification and then goes to consult with the god, and he mm-hmm. does so in an impure state, I think is probably ultimately what they're concerned about. Mm-hmm. The reason I say that is because, so if a man has sex with a horse, horses are not used for purification. But the Hittite law does say that if you have sex with a horse or in something else, some other kind of animal, you're not allowed in the presence of the king. And so they're very concerned, it seems to me, that they're worried about the purification of the king. They're worried that he's going to become impure and that that's going to bring wrath on the country or on the nation as he interacts with the god in an impure state.
Mm-hmm.
Can I just interject to ask sort of a general thing? So, you know, we've been talking and sort of moving broadly around the ancient Near East, sometimes dipping into the Hebrew Bible, Hittite laws. It's, so just so that everybody knows, Bruce Wells is your advisor. So of course, I'm sure that many people watching that name rings a bell. So writes very prolifically, but could you just talk a little bit with that background to how that's possible? You're thinking about what, you know, Bruce has written and what Raymond Westbrook wrote, this sort of broad legal ontology, maybe, if I'm using that term correctly here, and I think I am, sure. You know, about the application. How is it that we can say something in the laws of Hammurabi, and then we come down into, you know, mid to late first millennium, maybe talking about a biblical code? How is it that, you know, these things, we can even speak of them in the same way or in the same breath?
Okay, so yeah.
This wasn't one of the questions that I put to him, and so sorry about that.
That's okay. We'll come back to the bestiality thing too, because we still have to talk about the Bible and that. So Dr. Westbrook was really sort of the vanguard of arguing that there is a sort of broad ancient Near Eastern legal milieu, that there is, I don't want to say a background, but that everybody is sort of working from very similar positions and very similar judicial philosophies. And I think he's right about that. The similarities between the laws are much too great to not see some sort of dependence. Now, there are people who dispute that and who believe that these different codes sort of sprang up sui generis in each individual place. So the Israelite laws sprang up sort of on their own there without really any influence from anybody else. And the same with the Hittite laws, and the same, obviously, with the Assyrian laws and then the Babylonian laws. I think the overwhelming evidence is probably against that, simply because of, again, the laws seem too similar. They seem to cover very much a lot of the same things. They seem to use very similar language. And we know that basically Mesopotamia exported Akkadian scribes to Egypt and to Israel and to Ugarit and to Hatti and to all of these places. And when they export those scribes are taking their law codes with them. And so, and then they go and they talk to the scribes who are in Hatti and the scribes who are in Jerusalem and the scribes who are in Egypt. And so, they're, you just can't escape that there's going to be an exchange of ideas. I think it's just unreasonable to not think these scribes are interacting with each other and they're sharing each other's material, and it's being incorporated into those codes. Because who's writing the codes? Well, it's got to be the scribes. So they're learning from each other, and they're speaking to each other, and they're probably influencing each other on how what laws get written and how they get written, and penalties for the different laws and things like that. And so I think Dr. Westbrook was absolutely correct. That seems to be the most logical and the most reasonable explanation for how so much of this stuff looks very similar. Now, that does not take away from the fact that there are unique innovations in each place. So we just talked about the Hittite thing. Nobody else talks about bestiality the way the Hittites do. So you see something very unique there. But if you go through the majority of the laws, they look very similar to what we find in Hammurabi. When we look at, you know, the Book of the Covenant in Exodus, it looks very similar to the stuff that we find elsewhere. It's hard to imagine that they just covered the exact same material or substantially the same material without there being some sort of give and take between the cultures.
Thank you.
Now, we were talking about bestiality. We didn't talk about the Hebrew Bible and bestiality. It does not, so this again occurs in Leviticus. And there's not a direct comment on why you can't have sex with these animals. The indirect comment that's made in several places in the P literature, the priestly material, which Leviticus is priestly material, is that Yahweh, the deity, walks in the camp. And so there seems to be a very similar idea to the Hittites, not that it was necessarily borrowed, but again, just very similar to understanding if you do bad things, if you commit adultery, if you commit incest, if you have sex with animals, there is some sort of polluting effect, and bad things will happen if the deity comes in contact with that. And so that seems to be a facet that the Hebrews and the Hittites share. And again, they're the only ones that talk about bestiality. And so I tend to think that they're concerned about a particular issue that just does not seem to be a Mesopotamian concern.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. And I have one more question, and then we'll take a brief break and take audience questions. We've been talking a lot about laws and sexuality and laws governing sex as being related to property law, and the person that is wronged is the person who like owns essentially the woman, or not the animal, but the woman who is subject to sexual assault. How does this work if you have, or if is this even addressed, male-male rape?
Okay. So
you're a popular man today.
The doorbell's ringing. Yes. Okay. So in the Hebrew Bible, well, let me back up. Same-sex relations are not addressed at all in the Hittite law. They're not addressed at law at all in Babylonian law. There's only two places that it's addressed. One is in the Middle Assyrian laws. Mm-hmm. So 11th century BCE, and then Leviticus 18 and Leviticus 20 in the priestly material, anywhere from 5th to 8th century BCE, depending on where you want to place that. In the Middle Assyrian laws, it says, and it's strange, and it's actually subject to some interpretation. on the A tablet, Law 20 says, if a man sodomizes another man, then basically they castrate him. So the question there, because it only talks about the man who is the non-passive actor in that, there is debate about whether or not that's a rape statute. Mm-hmm. And whether it's forcible sex instead of just consensual sex, because nothing is said about the passive partner. And so in the Mesopotamian laws, that's the only law that addresses that. And it's somewhat ambiguous, because if it's addressing same-sex relations, then you would think the passive partner also would have some sort of a penalty. But mm-hmm. it's not. It's only the active partner. And they castrate them. And so they're obviously not happy with that arrangement or that action. And so I tend to think that it's probably same-sex rape because of that. But again, because the laws are incomplete, they don't cover every possibility. You have to hold out that it is just same-sex relations, and for whatever reason, either they didn't want to punish the passive partner, or that didn't make it onto the tablet.
Mm-hmm.
Now, within the biblical tradition, we have those two passages, one in Leviticus 18 and one in Leviticus 20. And I know y'all have discussed those on here, and obviously mm-hmm. Bruce has written on those. So the Bruce is written on, I can't remember which chapter it is, but there's one of the passages where the prohibition against same-sex relations seems to be embedded within the incest material. And Bruce argues that that is really a male-male incest prohibition, not a blanket same-sex prohibition.
Mm-hmm.
I'm still chewing on that. The other one is the one where it's actually outside of the incest prohibitions. It comes, I think it's after you can't have sex with a menstruating woman. You can't have sex with a woman and her daughter. And I think there may be one other that's sort of surrounding that. And it also puts in this prohibition against same-sex relations. If you have a prohibition against same-sex relations of any kind, then obviously you've outlawed same-sex rape. Mm-hmm. But, you know, Leviticus 18 and 20 don't give any punishments. They just say these are out of bounds. So, you know, it's unknown what that punishment would be if there is a same-sex sexual assault that takes place and the perpetrator is actually caught.
Well, I think we are going to wrap up there. Jay, thank you so much for joining us. This was fascinating.
Thanks, guys. I enjoyed it.
Well, thank you, everyone, for joining us today. And we'll see you next time here on the Hebane Podcast.